I'm Christopher Lydon with the writer Philip Weiss of the impassioned and red-hot website Mondo Weiss. His passion is the war of ideas in the Middle East. His great hope for the democratic revolution in Egypt is that it will change us, you, me, himself, and American foreign policy. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Philip Weiss, thank you for the chance to talk. Your conversation and your attitude, both American and global, confront what we think of as established Jewish voices in the power game. There's no avoiding the divisions and the hard feelings here, but this is not the Jerry Springer Show. I'm really interested in your ideas, how you came to them, how you decided to make a frontal campaign for them. You say there's handwriting on the wall of events. I hope you'll read it for us.
Well, I mean, part of my problem with reading the handwriting on the wall is that it's Arabic right now. And for the first time, I really feel possessed to study Arabic. And I think that that is the kind of glorious, glorious message of Egypt, is that Arabs are actually providing leadership to the world and also to the American discourse. And so, you know, that's just the great pleasure of these events today. And the great lesson of Egypt for Americans is that we are listening to Arabs. We're listening to them finally in this incredibly respectful way because we are so moved by their creativity and their imagination and their achievement.
You wrote 10 days ago an essay that moved me and made me think I had to meet you. You said that the Egyptian revolution would liberate American thinking from the crude paradigms about the Middle East that have held our political imagination in thrall for 50 years. Spell them out.
Well, I think that if you go back, I mean, my issue is Israel-Palestine and the mistake that I think partition was in 1947. I'm not undoing a mistake is a very hard thing to do, but I think that the great wisdom of the quote-unquote Arabists who were all over the State Department in 1947 and who were overruled by Truman, their great wisdom was the people in this part of the world don't want a Jewish state established. For whatever reason, they don't want it. And are we going to consult with the locals or not? And we chose not to consult with the locals. And the consequence of that was that because we are on the side of establishing a Jewish state and then on Israel's side for these many years, the consequence of that is that we have needed to demonize Arab public opinion. And demonize the Arab street and demonize Islam. These things have been necessary consequences of that decision. And the glory of Egypt is that even people like myself who've studied this issue and tried to liberate themselves from this thinking have been challenged on their racism about Arabs. And when I say my racism about Arabs, I think of all the ways that when I was in Egypt, I thought, oh, these people will accept a pharaoh forever. It's a patriarchal culture. They like the big man. They want to be, you know, all these neoconservative tropes I accepted. And I think Americans very broadly accepted. And again, I get back to this just glory of Egypt is that you saw such imagination, such creativity, such daring by these young people. And that has been something that all Americans, I think, have registered and with a shock. And that shock rivals the shock that was 1967 and the Israeli defeat of three Arab nations. In that case, Americans, I think, fell in love with Israel. That's my, whether it was packaged by the media or whatever, it was, there were bronzed Israeli soldiers on the front page of Life magazine, and people all over this country said, yes. And now we are seeing a very different image of the Middle East, and Americans are saying, yes. And it's just a glorious just experience.
Go back a moment, Philip Weiss, to 1947. If you'd been Harry Truman, with hindsight, what would you have done?
I think that Truman's motivation was seeing the displaced persons camps in Europe and the terrible suffering of Jews after the Holocaust. That was extremely moving to Truman. And the general problem here, philosophically, which, again, is not a straight answer to your question, but the general philosophical problem is that a European dilemma that had perplexed Europe for hundreds of years, how to deal with Jews, was solved by granting them a state in the Arab world. And that is very problematic, has been very problematic. As the State Department said, again, in 47, you will only establish this state by force and maintain this state by force. And those words, I can't think of a more correct observation about the future. I mean, I don't study history broadly, but there have been many wars. It's very unbalanced. Now there's this great panic over this treaty coming apart, you know. Anyway, so to try to give you a straight answer, I think that there should have been a greater effort to resolve a European situation in Europe. I guess I wonder if there, you know, truth and reconciliation are words from our era with a new age flavor, but I wonder if there should not have been a more earnest and genuine effort to deal with these questions on the terrain in which they had arisen.
Come back to the present moment and reading the handwriting. Your website is full of many, many levels of a new narrative for the world coming out of Egypt. Spell
it
out.
For the U.S., I think, especially, yeah. Well, you know, I think to be helpful to your listeners, I should begin a little bit at square one in explaining these lines of thought, and that is that the genesis of my website was in 2003. I was demonstrating against the Iraq war that was about to begin, which I knew would be a disaster. And I don't think I'm a prophet. I think any sensible person knew that it was crazy. And a relative of mine said, "What do you think of this Iraq war, Phil? I demonstrated against the Vietnam War, but my Jewish newspaper says this war could be good for Israel." And that statement is really why I became public on all the issues that I'm public on the blog. Every part of that statement, if you take it apart, I mean, that statement is one about Jewish identity, for me, critically, and Jewish political identity. And I had grown up as a good liberal Jew against the Vietnam War. And it is, so that's a true fact that Jews had that tradition. It's a true fact, as opposed to a false fact, that the Jewish community was split over the Iraq War, and that very important components of Jewish leadership, Jewish rank and file generally were against the Iraq War, as I was, but not as vociferously. But the Jewish leadership was, by and large, for the war, very important Jewish organizations. And even the Reform Jews, Union for Reform Judaism, supported the war against Iraq at some level. And this was, for me, a great abdication of an American Jewish tradition of opposing bad wars. And I knew nothing about Israel. I'd never been to Israel. And people perceived this war to be good for Israel. And so it became, I felt, you know, I was then pushing 50. I'd frittered my life away writing celebrity profiles for magazines. And I like to say that I compare myself often to another feature writer in Jewish life, Theodor Herzl.
Hmm.
And Herzl was...
Remind us.
Theodor Herzl is the founder of Zionism.
Hmm.
His picture is all over Israel. When they declared the State of Israel, his bearded mug was their giant photograph. You know, Herzl is the saint of Israel. Herzl was an Austrian journalist who was having a very happy life as a journalist until the Dreyfus trial in the 1890s. And as he would say, and he was a Christmas tree Jew, like me, a Christmas tree Jew. And he was having a perfectly good life until he discovered anti-Semitism and how virulent it was in Europe.
Mm.
And it changed his life, and he threw him into politics. And in my case, and he would say, he said later, I believe he said, it certainly was said of him, I think he said it actually, you know, anti-Semitism made me Jewish again. Hmm. And in my case, the neoconservatives made me Jewish again. A virulent ideology, I don't mean to put it on the level of anti-Semitism, but a virulent ideology of telling people to be democratic at the point of a gun, that did arise from the Jewish community, from the right-wing Jewish community. Neoconservatism is a very Jewish genesis. That made me Jewish again, in the sense that I threw myself into a Jewish communal life of a sort. I began to reach out to other Jews who were as upset mm-hmm. about this as I was. And I have located my own work in Jewish history, and to reclaim a very different tradition of Jewish life than the one that these bloody-minded nationalists have consecrated.
Hmm.
It's given me great purpose in life, for which I'm thankful. It is a vital task for the Jewish community to confront this issue.
Which bloody-minded nationalists are we talking about? I mean, be as specific as
Douglas Fife, Paul Wolfowitz. It's always hard to say how Jewish nationalist someone is. Elliot Abrams, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Scooter Libby. But certainly Tom Friedman, Ken Pollack. All these people who supported... my test on this, the neoconservatives generally supported the idea of the Iraq war partly because the road to Jerusalem led through Baghdad. There was a peace in Jerusalem involved taking out this dictator. It was a crazy idea. But for me, anybody who justified this war by talking about Saddam's support for suicide bombers in Israel, that's craziness to me. Because that made an American cause that we should sacrifice, this country should sacrifice blood and treasure for the sake of this Israel's problems with the resistance is crazy. That's a crazy error. That's an error. And it's conflating American interest with Israel's perceived interest. And it's a very bad reading, I think, of why people are strapping bombs to themselves in Palestine and Israel, or wars during the Second Intifada.
That connection, though, between Israel and Likud Israel and
yes.
the war in Iraq was absolutely obvious. And yet very little remark. I think Tom Friedman did write a column.
Friedman said, if you had gotten 25 guys out of Washington who are all within 1 mile of me, the Iraq war would not have happened. 25 neoconservative intellectuals.
Exactly.
If you had gotten them out of Washington, the Iraq war would not have happened. And it's a vital statement. It's a very important statement for which I'm grateful to Tom Friedman. And Joe Klein, who is in a position to know, has said a very, very similar thing, that this war came out of a Jewish neoconservative fantasy of a domino theory, that if you somehow knocked off one dictator, that it would create democracy and safety for Israel. It's a complete fucking delusion. This is not... I felt this was obvious. I think this will be obvious to historians, that this was an important component of this war. I don't claim to know every reason that we went to war with Iraq, but there's no question that when my liberal friends, my good liberal friends, say it was Bush and Cheney, when my mother says it's that bastard Bush, of course it's that bastard Bush. I'm not denying it's that bastard Bush. Bush has never had a thought in his head. And this war was driven by ideas. And who gave him the ideas? Who gave Cheney the ideas?
Mm.
And I think that you really have to look at the brain trust. I mean, The Best and the Brightest is not a book about JFK. It's about his brain trust.
Right.
And so why you know, I'm not interested in, you know, these are, you know, I'm interested where the ideas came from. And the fact is that some of the most important ideas here and the most disastrous ideas came out of the right-wing Jewish, American Jewish community that is extremely supportive of the Zionist project. There's just no question. And that is, again, this issue that American Jews have to, I was saying this 5 years ago, you have to confront this. They haven't confronted it. We haven't confronted it, but we're doing a much better job now than we were 5 years ago. And in another 5 years, this will be debated on stages at the Center for Jewish History. It's going to take a while.
So interesting the way you describe it. I guess the puzzle has been how in a free country was it so difficult to notice that or to publish it or to talk about it, fight about it?
I don't know the exact reasons we went to war. I think this is a very important component. And how large a component is something that is only discovered by open debate. So I think that we have the reason, but to answer your question, why haven't we had that debate? We haven't had it because of the history of anti-Semitism and the fact that it's an anti-Semitic trope that Jewish bankers and Jewish influence peddlers pushed societies to go to war, either to help Jews in those other societies who were threatened or to sell war bonds and that kind of thing. So, and given that this is an important anti-Semitic trope and that the Holocaust is this terrible chapter in our recent history that involves the United States as well, obviously, and not always in the best light. People say, you're not allowed to talk about this because people will start murdering Jews. That's the reason. People will start persecuting Jews if you even have this conversation. I mean, these issues arose in the late 1800s around the Dreyfus case, at a time when Jews were certainly achieving a lot in Central European and Western European society and were being victimized in Russia and Poland, the issue arose of this, the Jewish question. The Jewish question is what we're still struggling with, which was this idea of a society within a society, and that was sort of vital to the rise of the state. Jewish bankers were vital. Jewish finance was vital to the rise of the state in the 1700s, 1600s, and 1800s. And in turn, Jewish intelligentsia, Jewish doctors, journalists, scientists, lawyers, real estate developers, the Jewish imagination was vital to the rise of modern society in the late 1800s. And it gave Jews a very special position in those societies, but also one where there was a great deal of envy and hatred and prejudice and a glass ceiling and all that. And I don't think that, obviously, Europe did not reach a happy answer to these questions, but that is the conversation that seems to be beginning in the minds of American Jews when you question the Iraq War, or the right-wing American Jewish role in the Iraq War. If you even broach that subject, which I think is a very important subject, as I say, you seem to be bringing up this conversation that began began in the same field and ended very, very badly in Europe.
Cut ahead to this rather amazing turn of the year 2011, Tunisia, then Egypt, who knows where else. Mondo Weiss, every day, with many contributors now, is full of this sense of a kind of a new creation, not to mention a new narrative. Sketch it out. And then I want to hear about your day-to-day struggle, what it's like.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I just want to say, I mean, again, it's just a joyful, joyful time. At my website, we've just been echoing that spirit day in and day out because we are so excited.
Who's we, Philip?
I say that we are a community of people who, at the single issue we all share is a desire for that the 4 or 5 million people of Palestine get their rights, their basic human rights, which they've been denied. So the issue of Palestinian solidarity is central to the website. Now, I'm drawn to that because I think that that is a central moral Jewish task to heal my own community and to heal my country, the United States. So I come out of from a sort of American national interest requires that these people be granted their freedom, and Jewish wholeness, spiritual wholeness, and requires that these people gain their freedom. The community more broadly, though, they all share that idea, but some of them are communists, some of them are far left, some of them are realists. But I think they are generally people who regard the Iraq war as a disaster, who regard Zionism as an error, the idea that Jews, a minority, needs to go set up a state in some other land. There's a very anti-Zionist component on the site. I'm not sure where I am on that continuum. I think it's an error, but I don't. But certainly, there are a lot of people who just regard it as colonialist exercise, late imperialist. So it's a community of outs, political outs who are coming in. We are coming in. I don't know if it's going to be 5 years, if it's 10 years, but our ideas are just too important and too widely shared.
Explain the anti-Zionism piece and the battles it gets you into. I mean, for one thing, there's a huge backfire on that, and a deep search. What's going on there?
You know, Zionism is a kind of a living, powerful ideology in human affairs is 120 years old, give or take. And it called on a greater and greater and greater portion of the Jewish community worldwide came to believe in Zionism.
Pre-Holocaust.
Pre-Holocaust. And then after Holocaust, it really, you know, they were the Rolling Stones and the Beatles mixed together. I mean, they had, you know, they could fill stadiums. It was rooted in 19th century nationalism and even racial theory, but it certainly, it won the day. And after the 73 war, when Israel was on the brink of destruction, they say, I mean, I don't know how close, but it was certainly, it was, and after the 67 war, a whole generation was indoctrinated, of American Jews, was given the breathing tube of Israel and said, you hold the breathing tube for this country on the other side of the world. Without you, it will be swallowed up. And American Jews accepted that responsibility, just like a nurse in an ICU accepts the responsibility of keeping the ventilator going. And it was a profound responsibility in that it involved, changed the political identity of American Jews in the last 30 years. So what I'm saying is that this national project that was born in Europe for real reasons to respond to real issues, persecution, anti-Semitism, death threats, extermination, this ideology came to engage American Jewish life. Mm. And even the Louis Brandeises of the world and the American Jewish committees of the world and the Sulzbergers of the world, and by that I mean the German Jews who were integrated fully into Western societies, who'd never felt persecuted, even they accepted that breathing tube guardian responsibility. And what I and many other Jews in my, I'm 55, but younger Jews than myself, chiefly, are questioning that responsibility and are saying, wait, what is Herzl's real experience was discrimination and death to Jews in the streets of Paris. That was his real experience. What is your real experience? I say to Jews in America. A real experience is, I went to Harvard fucking college. I lead a really privileged life. I've never had an obstacle placed in my way, career-wise, that I didn't put there myself. And that is true of my whole generation and the next generation. The anti-Semitism is not a real factor in terms of economic, social opportunity in the coasts of the United States, certainly, blue state areas. And so what does that mean? What does that real experience mean to you about the central tenet of Zionism, which is that a minority is unsafe in a Western country? It's bullshit. That's what it says. It's bullshit. And the type of society that we treasure, in which a minority is safe and free, is one that we as a community are destroying in the Middle East, destroying it, that idea. And they're not even, they may not even be a minority, the Palestinians in Israel and Palestine. They may represent a majority at this point, but we're destroying that idea. And the denial of the conditions, the real conditions of Palestinian life by Jews is just, is shocking. It's shocking to me that my people would be so blind to the suffering. And I often say that we are, you know, Kafka has that story in which this horrifying device is revealed, the mechanical device that inscribes someone's crime on their body with sharp knives. And we have set up this machine to inscribe the Jewish experience on the body of Palestinians. That's my view, that they, being Jewish, was such a horrible storyline through the first half of the 20th century in Europe. It was a very bad story, very, very bad story. And we have taken every chapter of that fucking story, and we are going to make the Palestinians walk down that road, as because we didn't like that experience one bit. And our revenge on history is to make some other people undergo that, as if that's, you know, it's an emotional justice, and it's just a blindness to what is happening. So going to Gaza, as I did 2 years ago, the only thing I could think of was the Warsaw Ghetto. I just could not stop thinking of the picture book my mother gave me when I was, you know, young, of the Warsaw Ghetto. That's what I was seeing here. And then the people say you can't use the Holocaust analogy. I mean, that was the only way I could look at it. It wasn't, obviously, the Warsaw Ghetto ended with pure extermination, but it began with incredible discrimination, ghettoization, limit, you know, whatever. So anyway, it's a long answer to your question, but that's why anti-Zionism exists as a living force within American Jewish life, within American life generally, because Americans have to wrestle with the degree to which their establishment has consecrated the task of supporting Israel come what may.
Philip, it's no surprise that Gaza is the climax, in a way, of your story. You're now you're an editor of the Goldstone Report, which had a pretty rough time in the world and in American media. Spin out that piece of the story, the what seemed to me heroic role of Richard Goldstone, and the fact that he was, as we say, frog-marched off the island immediately for saying what he said.
Well, the Gaza war happened 2 years ago. It was something of a massacre. And
more massacre than war, I think it's safe to say.
More massacre than war, yes. 13 Israelis killed, nearly 1,400 Palestinians killed. And most of the Israeli soldiers, I think, were killed by other Israeli soldiers by mistake. There was very little combat in the way we think of it. There was 2 weeks of airstrikes on this imprisoned population. Here's a population of 1.5 million in a landmass the same size as Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket put together, and they're dropping leaflets on them telling them to flee. and they can't get out of that territory, and they're terrified, and they're dropping white phosphorus on them. And anyway, so this is a war, or this, if you call it, it, that shocked the conscience of the world, as it should, even though Anderson Cooper couldn't have gotten in there if he had wanted to. Anderson Cooper, a hero of the Egyptian Revolution. No journalists, there were journalists there, but they had to have been there or sneak in. You know, it was a very difficult war to cover, and yet it shocked the conscience of the world. And the United Nations said, we got to do something about this. There's got to be some accountability. And there's this history of one-sided UN resolutions against Israel that are vetoed by the United. You know, this is, they actually came up with a resolution that we're going to look at both sides. War crimes on both sides. And Goldstone, a hero of international human rights law, the post-Cold War effort to bring about a regime of kind of international law internationally, he has been at the forefront. This judge who came out of apartheid South Africa, who led truth and reconciliation efforts in apartheid South Africa, who helped abolish the group areas law of apartheid in South Africa, a hero of the anti-apartheid movement, a Jew. He was given the task of investigating war crimes around the Gaza war. And he came out with a 500-page report 10 months after the Gaza war, and said there were war crimes committed by both sides. And almost all his report was devoted to the Israeli side because it had committed so many more of them. But it also, he also said that Gazans, by firing rockets at civilians in Israel, were guilty of war crimes. So, as you say, the report was denounced widely, and there's been a campaign against it. And that campaign included almost getting Judge Goldstone disinvited from his own grandson's bar mitzvah in South Africa. It included Alan Dershowitz calling him a traitor to the Jewish people, Goldstone. And it's a vital document because it really says we're not singling Israel out. We're also looking at the other side. This is a judge who has the greatest integrity, and he's saying they're war crimes. And grave war crimes, and an assault on a civilian population. And when you bulldozed the chicken farms and destroyed 100,000 chickens in 3 hours, and when you destroyed the flour plant and the sewage processing and the juice factory, you were assaulting a civilian population. This was an assault on civilians. That is a grave violation of international law. And what's more, Goldstone said there will be universal jurisdiction for this, for these prosecution. And what he produced was a fact finding, it was not a legal document as such, but he said, if Tzipi Livni, the former foreign minister, shows up in your country, you can prosecute her for these crimes.
Really?
Because they've involved, it's a violation of a universal standard of international law that she did. And so she has not been able to travel because of this. And that is one achievement of the Goldstone Report, is that for once there is a sense on the part of Israelis that they are accountable for what they do to this occupied population. And that is a great, great thing. That is a great achievement. And I don't think that the Israelis would do Gaza again, which is a great, you know, that they would not visit such horrors on an occupied people is a great thing.
Philip, you're embattled around the Goldstone Report, around Gaza, yeah, around yeah. Zionism, around Jewish values, yeah. Jewishness.
Yeah. I guess I like battle. I have to admit, I do. I mean, I enjoy that. Temperamentally, I have that element of my personality.
Well, I was going to say, you're not alone by a long shot,
yeah.
And yet it's a fight every day. I wish you'd describe the battlefield. Who's out there? Who's rising? Who's falling? Who's discredited? Who's disgraced?
We are rising.
who's on the fence? What's the direction of things, do you think?
I think the direction, the arrow is, it's good arrow right now. Democracy is rising in the Middle East. Arabs are seizing it in their own two hands rather than having it forced on them by, you know, at gunpoint. That's a great thing. The neoconservatives who thought that you should bring force democracy on people at gunpoint and who destroyed an Arab society, killed, you know, tens of thousands of people. I mean, those people are on they're in disgrace in Washington. Finally,
it is a staggering point that people thought it was fine if we go in with bombers and incredible weaponry and tell them how to do it and destroy their country in the process. That's okay, but they should find it in their own hearts, on their own streets, is something to be terribly scared about.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't think about that. Yeah, you're right.
It's an astonishing point.
Yes, you're right. I think you're right. I think right now the neoconservatives are finally being disgraced. Egypt is helping to do that. There are elements of realist thinking entering Washington foreign policy establishment that and the idea that the Israel-Palestine issue is central to our problems in the Middle East is growing. That understanding is growing. Inside the Jewish community, the people who question Zionism, we are winning slowly. We're not winning at all, but we're winning battles on the fringes. And so at J Street is this Zionist group, pro-Israel group that's liberal in Washington. They have invited to their conference a woman who is in favor of boycotting Israel, a Jewish woman who's in favor of boycotting. So this is a verboten taboo idea that's actually an important idea. And she's going to get to make that argument at J Street. That's a good thing. So inside the Jewish community at last, to be egotistical about it, I don't get invited to Jewish spaces to put forward my ideas generally. But there is even curiosity about my ideas inside the Jewish community. And because I think young people recognize the truth of the central issue here, which is that the rights that they worship and live by here, they're destroying in another country.
How goes the battle among my people, the Goyim?
You know, my optimism distorts my proportion. It's sometimes hard for me to see what's big and what's little. Mm. But I see this as a very hopeful period in which non-Jews speak up about this question and say, you know what, I have a right to talk about Zionism too, because my country has been invested in Zionism and I don't believe in Zionism. And here's why I don't believe in Zionism. And I think that if you actually poll non-Jews about the question I want to poll American Jews on, do you feel a need for a Jewish state? Do you need a refuge? Why? Do you need a refuge? And what does that involve? Do you want a warehouse? Should we warehouse a country for you on the other part of the side of the world? So if things ever get hot here, you can go there 10, 20 years. Have you ever visited there? All these questions that I have about the Jewish commitment to this militant garrison state, I want to ask. I think that we should be asking non-Jews, Christians, Muslims too. Do you believe in a society in which leading figures are saying we shouldn't rent to Arabs? A society in which when they make a governing coalition, they exclude the Arab parties. Yeah, the people in Israel, the Arabs get to vote, but they're always excluded when they make the governing coalition. Do you think that's right? We did that in 1964 at the Atlantic City, you know, in the Democratic nominating convention. It was kind of a black mark on our history that we did that. They're doing that now in Israel. Do you support that? I'm not even talking about the conditions on the West Bank. I'm talking about the people who can. So that conversation has to happen, and I think it's starting to happen a little more. But again, my sense of proportion is really flawed.
Can I poll one non-Jew for you on this?
Yeah.
On this subject? I mean, most non-Jews wouldn't think of making an issue of Zionism for fear of anti-Semitism. Maybe the anti-Semitism in their own hearts in the, you know, that's out there. Or maybe just that it's none of our business. Also in media, I mean, there are two subjects on which mainstream media is completely unreliable. One, the web, because it so threatens them, and the other is Israel because it's, again, too plain tender. So I think most non-Jews just don't particularly care to go there, certainly not first. It might be dangerous, too, which may be part of the reason why it's so fascinating to see you walking your walk.
I've served that role, and I happily served that role. I put myself out there for anybody, Muslim, Buddhist, Jewish, Christian. I want you to think about these things because they are your business. You know, Walt and Mearsheimer are non-Jews who, at some level, they knew that they would get tarred as anti-Semites. But out of a duty to talk about these questions, they said, it's worth whatever happens, we're going through with this because this is so important. And so they emboldened people. They emboldened me. They emboldened me. Hmm. And I'm forever grateful to them for that.
There are young people in your fold, Philip. I wonder, what is moving them? Is it rediscovering the Jewishness of their grandparents? Is it events on the ground in their lives in the last 30 years? What do you see among your younger adherents, the rising generation?
Well, they were lucky. The thing is, it's moving them. In as much as they're engaged, they missed a couple of indoctrinations, very important indoctrinations that people of my generation got. And the two indoctrinations they missed specifically is that the Holocaust stuff. I mean, in the 70s, America discovered the Holocaust with, you know, great fury, as well it should. You know, it was a vital thing to discover the Holocaust. But that education, while mandatory now, is not as vivid. You know, there aren't a lot of Holocaust survivors around. When I was a kid, you know, my mother could point at some guy's arm on the beach and say, that's from Auschwitz, the tattoo on his... Now, you can still have that experience in America. Right half a mile from here is a guy who has an Auschwitz tattoo on his arm. But it's much harder to come by that experience. And young people are not as... It doesn't seem as real to them. It's history. So that's one indoctrination that there... Because there is an element of indoctrination. I want to insist on that Holocaust education. There's a truth and then there's a myth, and it's never accompanied by any description of the Nakba, in which 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their lands by Jews within a couple of years of the few years of the Holocaust. So they're missing that indoctrination, and they're also missing the heroic indoctrination of the 67 and 73 wars. They were generally born after that, and the idea of this people reborn after the Holocaust in the Middle East and heroically against all odds overcoming Arab armies and swarthy Arabs, they missed that generally. So they got involved in the story late, and they look around and they think, wait a second, what's this fucking story? You know, so young Jews who are getting the Israel story, the happy sing-along and dance Israel story, are getting the slaughter of 1,400 people in 22 days in Gaza. They're getting unarmed activists on a boat being landed on by helicopter commandos in the middle of the night. You know, so they're getting kind of bad stuff. I mean, the funny thing about, that's why Egypt, again, is significant. Egypt is such a happy story. Mm. You know, if you're a young idealistic, people like who are young like to feel idealistic about their politics. How do you feel idealistic about your politics and be supporting Israel? I just don't. I think that's a really hard thing to do, especially if as soon as you start to examine it, it's really hard to do. And you don't feel good about your politics. Maybe you have a tragic view of history and you rationalize Israel on that basis. It's going to happen to Jews again. You know, it's not a happy story. To justify what's happening is not telling a happy, happy story. It's telling a very dark story. And I don't think kids like doing that. You know, Egypt's a fun story to tell. People like telling stories about human fulfillment and overcoming tyranny. So
Philip Weiss, you found your place in the battle. You're more than holding your own. I want to know, who are your great models? Who are your friends in this fight? And who are the people you're afraid of?
My great models are tend to be writers who, I'll tell you a great model. Noam Shazoff is a young Israeli journalist. He's 35 and extremely intelligent. I'm an ethnocentric person. I grew up thinking Jews are better than other people. Noam reminds me of those feelings, why we sanctified Jews, because he's just a lovely, he's just...
Spell it out.
Noam is an extremely confident person. He is highly intelligent. He's got a humility to him. And he's, any question he can flick off instantly with a good answer. And a very serious person. And Noam, what he said that to me that I find riveting is, you know, I wish I could write about film. That's what I really want to write about. I want to write about movies. The urgency of these times have commanded me to throw myself into these political issues. As an engaged blogger, he explained blogging too. He said, blogging is engaged journalism. I think that's a very good definition. And it explains the problems with traditional journalism and what the internet has done to open up people's point of view more. But so here that's one of my, he's a great model to me because he's thrown himself into this issue and he knows that the only way to resolve this issue is to come to terms with the Palestinian presence as equals. It's a beautiful thing to watch. So he's a great model. And I think of writers in the past, great writers in the past have who, I'm an ambitious writer, and ambitious writers have always, great ones have really tried to involve themselves in moral questions of that. I mean, Thoreau is such a great, you know, American example.
Amen. And
so the abolitionists, you know, the abolitionist, Abraham Lincoln, you know, our greatest president. I don't know, I leaving aside the Civil War chapter, this is a man who was a complete outsider in American political life in the 1850s. He had one term in Congress, an eccentric, an intellectual, and a moderate, whose hatred of slavery drove him and his belief in a conspiracy in the American political structure to support slavery after Kansas, Nebraska in 54, the destruction of the Missouri Compromise, the extension of that sin, that incredible sin, that turned him into such a purposeful human being. And he created a party. A new party was created because the existing party structure was so corrupted by the slave power. I mean, that's the greatest model that exists for me in American life. I mean, then the civil rights movement, they're great models. And Daniel Ellsberg, I mean, they're just our world. You know, American history is strewn with Werner and Cheney Goodman. You know, people, I don't have their bravery, but, you know, we have these wonderful moral models of nonviolent engagement. I mean.
On the other side, who's your most worrisome enemy? Who's the worst person in America out there, as Keith Olbermann might ask?
I think, unfortunately, you know, it's these the ones who I'm really engaged with are these liberal Democrats who, excuse me, are liberal in all respects except on this issue. And so they are the Jerry Nadlers and Chuck Schumers and Barney Franks even of the world who claim the liberal mantle and claim to be liberal leaders and are liberal leaders in many respects in American public life, but are shitting on this issue. And therefore are misleading a whole important political segment of our society. And so when my relative said to me, you know, this war for Iraq might be good for Israel, I think that that is the corruption that exists within liberal Jewish life to this day, is that they're worried about Israel. Mm-hmm. So that even something as glorious as the Egyptian revolution is questioned because it might not be good for Israel. And that selfishness, that's the greatest thing I'm against is the idea in Jewish life, the idea that could actually gain traction, that 85 million people in Egypt should suffer tyranny for the sake of Israel's preservation. These people have no hopes or dreams. That selfishness is brutal. And that comes out of, is it good for the Jews thinking? That is my greatest enemy in Jewish life. Is it good for the Jews? And that exists in my own family and all through Jewish life. And so that is very upsetting to me and is a very powerful force and a threatening force in some ways and has to be taken on.
Does anybody threaten you?
In what sense?
I don't know. You scared of anybody? Is Alan Dershowitz going to come and bite you?
I think Alan Dershowitz, you know, someday I'll probably engage. I hope I get to engage Alan Dershowitz someday. He used to mostly these people ignore me. You know, they've tried to ignore me. They've tried to say that I'm a Jeffrey Goldberg once said I'm not a Jew. He put me in the group of people who are non-Jews, which is stupid and is vicious. But it's an effort to marginalize me. And that has been done successfully by many establishment Jews. They've ignored me. And when they have referred to me, said that I'm not allowed to be in the conversation.
What about the non-Jewish political establishment? I mean, how's it doing, including our President Barack Obama?
He's doing terrible.
There was a moment early in his campaign when he said, you know, let's remember that the Palestinians are the ones who are suffering out there.
That's right.
And he was taught not to say that again. But how do you map him since then?
Terrible. He's terrible. I mean, he's not, he's a politician, but he's also not shown any leadership, I don't think, on this issue. And the comment you refer to, he made in Iowa in 2008 to a woman named Sue Dravis, who asked him about this, and he said, Palestinians are the ones who are suffering the most. And he has walked back from that statement, which he knows to be true, which is a pure fact. He's walked away from that ever since. And the next year, in June 2009, he said to me in Cairo, I was sitting in Cairo, I was one of the hundreds who he said this to in Cairo, at the University of Cairo, the settlement project must stop. Must end. This is the Palestinians are being humiliated. That must stop. And he's done jack shit about that, what he said to us in Cairo. He's abandoned that.
Not jack shit. He has stared at Bibi Netanyahu with that news and been told to take a walk.
Right, right. So that was, 2 years ago? And he has been stared down by Netanyahu, and he has abandoned it, that idea that the settlements must end, I think because of money for the 2012 campaign. I think that's basically it. He doesn't want to, he's like any good politician, he's got a conservative political component, you know.
He's also got a Congress that would tell him to take a walk too.
Right. But it's like what Lincoln described, where there's a sin and everybody's in on the sin. And it's a conspiracy. Lincoln called it a conspiracy to support slavery, which we all agree was a sin. And what we have now is a conspiracy of Republicans and Democrats and Obama, too, not to condemn the settlements, which are merely the worst part of my wife, you know, has never been there. I brought her over to Israel and Palestine. You know, I've been there many times. I'm deeply immersed in this issue. She doesn't really get involved in this issue. She went there for the first time last year, and she said the two-state solution is a will in which, you know, you get the big house and they get the toilet in the backyard. She looked around. It was plain as day how unfair the process is. That's what is created. It's not. This isn't. Doesn't take a ride, you know. It's very obvious how unfair this is, and the cruelty of the occupation. That's very obvious if you visit it. My wife, I mean, she didn't want to have to see it. She went to Beilin and saw the demonstration. These people doing what they did in Egypt in an occupied village are getting tear gassed and clubbed and shot rubber bullets at, and we say nothing about that. And Anderson Cooper doesn't go there to protest, to talk about that. But the same thing is happening to the... I'm ranting. I'm sorry. But Obama has shown no leadership on this question, and no one in Congress has shown any leadership. And so we have a bunch of cowards who know that it's wrong and that it's hurting American interests. And they say it privately, as Joe Biden says it privately. This is costing us American money and lives. But they're afraid to say it publicly.
So what are you going to do that doesn't feed Jew hatred? What are you going to do that doesn't violate Jewish and Israeli interests today? What are you going to do that, without starting a civil war in American politics,
I don't know what's wrong with
brings
civil war.
Around a hugely powerful interest in the game, which is to say, the American Jewish interest?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the nonviolent way that I deal with all that, or the kind of happy, you know, nice way, is to have this, try to have a conversation within the American Jewish community. That's what I've been doing in my, you know, persistent manner, is to say, do you need a Jewish state? Why do you need a Jewish state? You seem to be doing fine here. I haven't moved there. And you know that the people who were born there can't even live there. And you're allowed to move there. You've never been there. You know, all these contradictions are things I'm raising. I'm trying to change Jewish consciousness on this, because if Jewish consciousness changes on this, then American politics will change, because Jews are so central a component of American political establishment. So, I mean, I'm just talking now. Now I'm speaking as a journalist. That's my role, is to try to educate American Jews about this, and educate the Americans generally about how our politics work on this question. I'm trying to reach those educated people who are so influential in the process and say, you know, you've been sold a bill of goods here. Tony Kushner called your understanding of Israel a fantasy on top of a delusion. That's what it is. Let me tell you why. And get you to change your mind about this. And I feel like that's a war in some respects. You talked about a civil war in the politics. What's wrong with that? You know, isn't that what politics is supposed to be? Not. I mean, I don't mean that people should get hurt, but, you know, it's vital that these issues are discussed. I think that I want a civil war in Jewish life. I want the Jewish family. My dream is to have a Jewish family on stage arguing about this in front of everyone. Do you remember what it did for gay rights that Lance Loud was coming out on fucking television in, when? Was that in the 1970s?
Forever ago.
Okay, it was a long time ago, but that was a riveting. That family, whatever price they paid in their privacy, and certainly they entertained us, but they also helped liberate a lot of suffering homosexual. I mean, the liberation of gay people is a wonderful thing that we can point
families
to.
Families in general. Yeah.
Right. And the dysfunctional. Lance, that family paid a price for it. And I want the Jewish family on stage to be having that reality show around this issue, so that people get to see my surrogate in that family. And then there are many of them out there, the young Jews. I want to see the tears. I want to see the rage. I want to see the charges of betrayal. I want this all out on the stage. I want that you're betraying, you're a traitor, you hate, self-hating Jew. I want the whole fucking thing. I want everyone to watch.
Mm.
And I want that, because it's vital. It's just like the gay people. In the Jewish family, these people have been closeted. They're just like, I've never thought about this before. They are just like the gay people. In when they were closeted, and a lot of them are afraid to come out, and a lot of people who help me on my website are not public. A lot of the Arabs aren't, and a lot of the academics aren't, and the government officials aren't, because their careers would suffer. But some people are, for very personal. I mean, one guy says, "I can't tell you, you can't use my name because my father will have a heart attack." And he's, you know, he says he's sincere. I think he's crazy, but whatever. But this should be done publicly. This should be an open, and were I a dramaturg, you know, I think that that's, I might try to, but right now I want it to happen in reality, and I'm actually trying to find a Jewish family that'll do it, because the neocons believe what they believe. But I think as soon as they start offering their bullshit on stage and start talking about anti-Semitism on stage, I want Americans to understand what price we are paying for the belief that anti-Semitism is a persistent factor in Western societies and that Jews need a refuge. I want Americans to have a right. They have a right to judge that, the reality of that statement. I want that out there. I want that whole conversation to be happening because, you know, anyway, that would be a vital, vital task.
That's a wonderful prospect. I'll go to the play.
Yeah.
I'll watch the show.
It would be good. It would be good bloody theater. It'd be Edward Albee meets... It would be a reality show, you know, but with real stakes, high stakes for Americans.
It's a Harold Pinter play.
Yeah, that's true.
Did you ever see The Homecoming?
Yeah, of course.
We saw a tiny glimpse of it in the Sarah Silverman performance for Obama on the web, right? In 08? Talking to her grandparents in Florida?
No, we didn't. Sorry. I don't think we did. I didn't like that statement. Hmm. He's good for Israel, Mom. He's good for his grandma. He loves Israel too. I don't think Sarah. I don't know. I don't trust her on the issue. I don't trust her.
Well, no, you're talking about a step up.
Oh, I see. There was some entertainment value. There was a fight within the Jewish. Right. I'm sorry. I'm not taking your message. She was willing to expose differences in the Jewish family to serve a political end.
Yes.
And I'm saying, Sarah, you ain't seen nothing yet, you know.
It's true. Tell us what we're going to see in this wonder year of 2011. Unfold the narrative as far as you can see it advancing in the Middle East, in American politics.
Well, the problem is that's the type of vision I have is so positive and starry-eyed and crazy. I just think that the accretion, the drip, 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 that is American awareness of this, that is respect for Arabs as human beings increases. And when you make the disastrous recognition that Arabs can be brilliant and creative and seize their own destiny bravely with tools, using tools that Facebook that we use to, you know, hook up at bars and meet people and get laid and find out what you're doing after a high school reunion. They use these same tools to build freedom, you know. That's just amazing. They took these things we built and just have done the greatest, you know, have taken us into a future dimension of visualizing. You know, oppression creates incredible sophistication in people. Palestinians are enormously sophisticated. And I hope that some of the incredible, these Gandhis across Palestine are doing such creative acts to try to get our attention, something like Tahrir Square. That's my prayer. And that's the best hope, I think, is that this drip, drip, drip will allow people to, in America, to begin to understand that Tahrir Square is also in Palestine. So... Mm.
I just hope we Americans really can deal with it, with taking a lesson in democracy, our great export. We're so proud of it, and rightly so. Can we take a lesson from 20-year-old people who are putting their health and livelihood and future, maybe their lives, on the line to build a new society without violence, without hatred, without messianism, without religion?
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm all for religion too, but to do it as a collective experiment in everything we say we love. Can we learn it from that far abroad, from people that we haven't esteemed in general?
Yes.
It's an incredible adventure for us, which takes us back to the start of your essay.
I mean,
this is for us, all of us.
Yeah, I love it. It's mind-blowing. But I mean, that's one of the great things about Americans. You know, we love America, you and I. We both
Thank
love
you.
America. Okay, I know that about you. And I really... see the best in my country. And when I look back on the fact that we did free the slaves late, you know, we did have the civil rights movement, gay liberation, you know, we did some of these things. And now, and those were shocking things. Mm. I was sexist. I was homophobic. I overcame those things. Now Americans are going to overcome their Arabophobia. They are really going to have to tackle that.
Yeah.
And it'd be great.
You say it beautifully. Sonny Rollins may have said it a little tiny bit better. Well, he said just recently, he said, you know, it's a flawed society, but he said, you know, Groucho Marx, Ella Fitzgerald,
these things happen in America.
Great. That's funny. That's great. I didn't know he said that. That's great.
But it's true. Anything's possible. Philip Weiss, it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks. It's been fun.
Real privilege. Thank you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.